Thanks, Malia. Hello, everyone. I'm Jason, alcoholic, dipsomaniac, whatever. I mean, my heart's racing, so bear with me. It's only my second ever share. I've been putting this off for months with Mark. It's been very patient, but I'm glad he sprung this on me last minute. So it's time to worry about it. So I guess I'll do a sort of a hodgepodge chronology and then sort of jump in randomly with whatever I've forgotten. First drink I suppose must have been like about age six or seven. My dad gave me sips of brandy and baby sham and Advocar and stuff, and you know, familiar thing, kind of tasted disgusting at first, but then I don't know, slowly grows on you, doesn't it? Then I suppose about 11, 12, there was some sleeping out in tents in back gardens and drinks cabinets raided. And varying results. I remember one time, first time got drunk and giggly. I think the second time I blacked out and was told the next day that I was constantly getting up to go to the toilet, and I was thinking, that's strange, I don't remember that. I don't know whether to believe these stories, you know, me causing problems. And I think the third time I got really, really ill. I mean, like really ill, because I remember the first and second times I'd kind of liked it, but I was like, I want to see, you know, I want to get properly drunk this time. And so yeah, I did drink way too much sweet Thunderbird wine, and I've still, you know, even during my drinking days, it was something I would never go back to. Very ill. And I remember lying there thinking, oh God, I've really got to figure this out. You know, if I'm going to be a proper adult, I've really got to figure out how to do this properly, you know, it seems to be a very familiar story in the rooms, trying to figure out how to do it properly, you know, hence a lifetime of misadventures. And definitely felt that way in the pub. Like it's very much that kind of divided self of wanting to be drunk but wanting to hold it together at the same time, and you know, all the fear the next day of, you know, I had some great times, but I had some really bad times and real mortified times, you know, waiting for the phone to ring and hear about that hour or two that I'd lost, and you know, whether it was a fun time or a bad time. But usually when I woke up, I had a vague sense of which of the two, or which kind of nuances between kind of how it was going to be reported back. I remember always trying to control my drinking. I was For most of my drinking, I was, weekend binge drinker. I was always very mindful of the potential for addiction. My kind of awareness of my own addiction fluctuated. You know, it fluctuated between denial, sort of acceptance, you know, sort of fearful acceptance, joking acceptance. And all the shades in between. I always tried very hard not to drink Monday to Friday. University, I suppose, I tried daily drinking with not much success, but definitely when I had a job after graduating, I was like, I've got to try and do this. But there was always been beer adverts coming on the telly, and I was just aware of how triggering that was for me. And but I was fairly successful at staying off it until I got really into my sort of 30s, I suppose, late 20s, 30s. And I'd always been a lot of interest in drugs as well. I mean, I really preferred drugs to alcohol. Alcohol was just, you know, just there and easy available. And so a lot of my friends were quite sniffy about drugs. Not the kind of sniffy I would have liked, but I mean, I mean, drugs, I mean, marijuana never really agreed with me. And I learned that from a very early age, despite trying very hard, you know, to make marijuana work, it just didn't. So, I mean, speed was my first love affair. I absolutely loved that. Then coke, you know, MDMA, ketamine, you know, most of them, I suppose, short of smack and crack, really. But yeah, I did love the drugs, but I suppose I was, you know, at the time I was resentful that that more of my friends weren't into the wonders of drugs. And in retrospect, I'm, you know, very grateful now that they weren't, because, yeah, so fast forward to 2011, I was, I'd been on and off of antidepressants for years. I remember coming off of antidepressants, the SSRIs, just so that I could get back into using ecstasy properly, you know, without getting borderline serotonin syndrome and blacking out for several hours and just not really being able to enjoy it. Yeah, 2011, there was this, it was called in the UK press, Meow Meow, methyl methcathinone, or MCAT as it was known, which was a so-called designer drug. Felt very much like MDMA, but it was far more toxic, really. MDMA is not great for the heart, but this stuff is. Yeah, and I got really into that, and it was just before the ban, I was ordering, like, I suppose, 10 gram bags of it in the post direct from China, you know, so pretty much almost 100% pure. And yeah, by the end of that run, it was every weekend. Drugs had always been kind of once in a while, you know, but this was like, now there was a unavailable, you know, just a completely available great source for it. It was every weekend, and I really saw the potential for that getting out of hand. And the ban came, and I probably just in time, really, and I put the drugs down, and I also tried at that time, I thought, right, I'll put the drugs down and maybe plow on with a drink. But before I did that, I had 6 weeks where I stayed off of alcohol entirely. And at the end of that 6 weeks, I was just like, fuck this. Sobriety, it's not worth it. I'm just going to plow on with the drink and try and avoid drugs. And that's what I did for the next 5 years. And by 2017, I'd really hit what I thought was my bottom, before the bottom fell out of that. And then things got even worse, and got in trouble with the police. And it was just really, really bad. So Hillingdon Drug and Alcohol Services had said my second key, the first key worker was a nightmare, but the second key worker, she was great. And she's just kept gently mithering me, saying, you've got to go to AA, get your shit sorted out. And I had all the usual reservations about going. I didn't want to go, didn't want to do the God thing. And I don't know, probably had, you know, the usual egomaniac with the insecurity complex. You know, I just didn't. That's not for me, you know. And I had actually been to a couple of meetings in 2011 when I tried that 6 week period of sobriety. I'd been to two meetings, and I just saw all the scrolls on the wall, and didn't really hear much that I related to in the shares. I just thought, well, fuck this, it's not for me. I'm going to plow on with a drink. So then 2017, I went to a couple of meetings, had a slightly better experience of it, but it still wasn't really clicking. I was going to meetings, going to the pub straight after. But then I went to, I think that maybe my third meeting of 2017, I went to what became my home group, a traditional group in West London, in Northfields. And the woman that was sharing, she just told my story, the whole lot. It was just, I was just like, ah, okay, looks like I'm probably in the right place. It was a real eye-opener. And so I carried on going to that that meeting, and it was really good for me for the first year or two. But then, someone in a meeting, not in a Tuznua meeting, but in another meeting, described the fake it till you make it kind of trying to get your head around the higher power thing when you don't really believe it. He described it as Orwellian double think. I just thought that's brilliant, because that's what I was trying to suck up. And I was just got to a stage where, again, I was coming out of meetings and going straight to the pub, you know, and relapsing quite regularly. I'd managed like 5.5 months. That was about the longest I'd managed. And then invariably it would be anything from around 3 or 4 months, and then I'd relapse, and I was just on that, and just was getting more and more jaded with traditional. And then the Zoomiverse opened up. You know, I knew that there were meetings, secular meetings in East London where I used to live before I got priced out and moved back here. So I knew there were meetings there, but the thought of spending like 3.5 hours on the tube there and back just negated any benefit that the meeting might have given me. So I never got around to going. But then, you know, COVID happened, and one of the unexpected benefits of all that horribleness was all this world of meetings opening up online. So still got some great home groups in London, and obviously in Tuznua, which is Tuznua's just taken it to the next level for me, because I'd had some pretty raw open shares on Zoom, but I mean it's really good. It's really gone to a different level. If I've got something that's really bothering me, then you know, some of you will probably have heard me do some really toxic and just quite vile shares, really. I couldn't have imagined, you know, saying those kind of things in a traditional meeting. But I don't know, Tuznua has really opened up a space of where I'm really, you know, tormented by whatever's going on in my head, then I can say that, and I won't necessarily be excommunicated for it. So that's been really incredible. I feel a bit emotional. I'll take a few deep breaths. I might have a look at my notes, which I failed. My printer wouldn't work. Hang on a second.
Yeah, so... I don't know. My mind's gone a bit blank now, but should we leave it at that? I've been talking for 15 minutes. I think, I mean, generally in secular, I'm going to feel like I feel like I'm hanging out with the adults now. In traditional, I just did not. And apologies to people. I mean, my sponsor's still a traditional guy, and he's lovely. And I would definitely class him as an adult, but as a broad generalization, I just feel like I'm in the right place now. I mean, really, really intelligent people, funny people, creative people. It's just all, they're all here. And I'm very, very grateful to be here with them. And there were some other things I could slip in, but I think I'll just leave it there. Yeah, I'm just very grateful to be here. So, thanks for asking me.